It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, a conversation with U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker. Ambassador Crocker is one of the most highly decorated Foreign Service officers ever to serve our country. He's currently Dean and Executive Professor at the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. He retired from the Foreign Service back in April of 2009 after a career of over 37 years, but then was recalled to active duty by President Obama to serve as U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan in 2011. He's served as U.S. Ambassador six times to Afghanistan, but also to Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. Ambassador Crocker is speaking in Des Moines today. Today, Wednesday, Drake University is hosting the ambassador as part of the July meeting of the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. And because Ambassador Crocker is speaking in Des Moines today, we recorded our conversation with him yesterday, Tuesday, just hours after the announcement about the nuclear deal with Iran. So I began by asking Ambassador Crocker how he sees the significance of the agreement.
It is a very significant agreement. There is not a precedent for this in the history of the NPT. A very detailed, very comprehensive agreement that I think, if properly implemented, takes a nation that may have been moving toward a nuclear weapon on a different course entirely, making the world a much safer place. A lot of questions to be asked and answered about the agreement itself, all 159 pages of it, but it has the potential to transform security in the Middle East in its most deadly and dangerous component, the nuclear arena.
How many of the details of this treaty are you looking at? How deep are you digging into it?
Ben, to be absolutely honest, because I'm inherently lazy, I intend to let experts who really know this stuff do the initial analysis, and then I'll take a look at it. Mm-hmm. Certainly in a once-over, I think the key boxes are checked in terms of inspectors and oversight access to nuclear facilities, clear long-term restrictions on what the Iranians can and cannot do in terms of enrichment, tight limit on their stockpiles, something that was very important, at least to me, continuation of the conventional arms embargo 5 to 8 years out. A quick once-over on this suggests to me that all the elements are there for an agreement that will guarantee to the world that Iran is not going into the nuclear weapons business. Now, devil is in the details. That's got to be very thoroughly assessed by people a lot more qualified to do so than me. And implementation, obviously, is key. There, too, though, I think the way this is written, the Iranians have to perform first. The sanctions don't come off until they have clearly demonstrated they are moving ahead with implementation on their side. So it looks to me, first glance, this is hours old, that the necessary checks are there. I don't see any glaring omissions. But again, the details are going to have to be gone through, and then we have to see how implementation proceeds.
Expand more on the turning point. Using words like landmark and historic here, a turning point that has to go back to at least the Iran hostage crisis of 1979 and 1980. What do you see as a possible turning point this agreement could mark?
Well, I think we have to be careful here. I do think this is potentially a turning point, but it is in the nuclear realm, and that is what is restricted to. It doesn't get into all the other issues between us since 1979, but nonetheless, a turning point. If this is properly and successfully implemented, it would be the first time through an international negotiation, a nuclear threshold power signed on to an agreement committing it not to pursue a nuclear weapon. So, again, it's all about implementation, but we haven't had that before. And what makes it different, say, than the failed North Korea agreement, is this is truly an international agreement, not just the U.S., but five other world powers have stood together and come to this conclusion. So it could reshape the nuclear scene globally for some time to come. That's significant. That said, Ben, no one should think that as a result of this, we are moving on to a sun-dappled upland in the Middle East where everything is going to be rosy far into the future. Mm-hmm. I do not expect any change in Iranian behavior with respect to their support for Hezbollah, the Assad regime, radical militias in Iraq, the Houthis in Yemen, and on it goes. This agreement does not change any of that. So, again, a very important milestone, but let's not get carried away in its transformational aspects. This is a nuclear agreement. It's not a broad-gauged political agreement.
The way you're interpreting it, certainly as a win for the United States, there are, of course, voices in the United States who would differ with that view, also in voices in Israel who would differ with that view. But give us, first of all, if you can, since you've consulted with the Iranians at a diplomatic level over decades in various scenarios, can you give us a sense of the Iranian government's perspective on this deal? Why did they agree to what the president says is cutting off all paths to a nuclear weapon?
There are several ways one can look at what motivated the Iranians. It may be that, if one wants to be really optimistic, that they never intended a nuclear weapon, so that it was easy for them to give up that to which they did not aspire. I think it's probably more complex than that. I think they were certainly holding open a nuclear weapons option. I think that we, working with the international community, eventually made the cost too high. The very, very severe sanctions that has crippled their economy may have simply changed the minds of Iranian decision makers as to what a cost-benefit ratio was. This is a case of coercive diplomacy. That's what sanctions are. Sanctions often don't work. I would suggest that in this case they have worked in changing Iran's strategic calculus to bring us to where we are. And very clear Iranian statement, and incidentally was struck by the language on that in the agreement, in which the Iranians basically say that under no circumstances will Iran ever seek, develop, or acquire any nuclear weapons. Pretty breathtaking statement. So I think this combination of coercive diplomacy through sanctions and offering the Iranians a way forward into the international community came together to produce what we've got today.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're a bit surprised at the announcement.
The agreement, as I read through it, is actually better than what I thought was achievable. Not that I thought we were going to sign up for anything necessarily less than this. I had come to think in the last day or two that these negotiations might simply fail. So, again, I wasn't in the room, and no one who wasn't can ever truly know. But I think what we're looking at today represents some significant concessions by the Iranians over the last several days.
U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker is my guest this hour. He's visiting Iowa, hosted by Drake University in a talk in Des Moines. And he's joining us in this conversation just hours after the announcement of the historic agreement, nuclear deal with Iran in exchange for the lifting of sanctions with the six powers. Let's talk about opposition to this briefly, if I could get your reaction there. The Israel Prime Minister, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, denouncing this as this deal. He's clearly going to pressure allies in the United States Congress to derail this agreement, as he has up to this point. If this is indeed the best agreement possible, as the president says, and exceeds your expectations, at least at first glance here, and I know it's been only hours since this has been this announcement has been made, it cuts off all paths to Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. Why is Israel against it?
Israel, where you stand depends on where you sit, and Israel sits in the Middle East. They have experienced firsthand the impact of Iran's terror strategy, having to cope with Hezbollah on the Lebanese border and now in Syria, and, of course, Hamas in Gaza, both terrorist organizations, both strongly supported by the Iranians. And as I said, this agreement, it's a nuclear agreement. It is not a broader agreement, and it does nothing to limit what the Iranians are doing in support of terror organizations that target Israel. So Israel has every right to be concerned. That said, it does not seem that the right way to proceed is to tear up the agreement. Removing an Iranian nuclear threat is no small part of security in the Middle East. But what we have to be clear-eyed on and understand the Israeli perspective on is that there are other security threats emanating from Iran that this agreement doesn't touch, and we're going to have to figure out a way to counter those.
Mm-hmm. Secretary of State John Kerry says Israel is safer under this agreement. However, Republican presidential candidates, to name a group, immediately attacked the deal. Here's a quote from South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham talking about this historic accord. He says it is, quote, akin to declaring war on Israel and the Sunni Arabs. He also went on to say, if you think this is a good deal, then you're dangerously naive. This is the most dangerous, irresponsible step I've ever seen in the history of watching the Middle East, according to Lindsey Graham. Your reaction, Ambassador Crocker, as someone who has served as ambassador to a half dozen countries in this region, to those remarks?
You know, hearing comments like that would almost make me think that a presidential campaign is heating up in this country.
especially in Iowa.
And especially in Iowa, which is why I'm coming. No, I'm not a candidate. But look, that's part of our system. It's part of our process. And, you know, why I may not agree with a lot of what's said out there, I think it's good to have these things said. It's going to ensure a very thorough debate on everything that is or isn't in that agreement. You know, that's good for the American people. It's good for international security. Again, a quick run through it suggests to me that if it is fully implemented and there are checks to ensure that it is, it is going to enhance global security, and that's security for all nations. So let's have the debate, but also let's take a pause from the rhetoric to be sure we're actually looking at the facts before we make judgments.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the wider implications of this in the Middle East. How does this landmark agreement potentially change or the dynamics of the Middle East? For instance, what countries in the Middle East do you see as having the most to gain or to lose from this agreement?
That's an important point, and one that Senator Graham touched on as well. I would hope we are having a very frank, comprehensive dialogue with our Arab friends and allies, starting with Saudi Arabia. Many of the Arab states have been deeply concerned over what Iran is doing and where this nuclear negotiation might lead. So we need to be sure we're addressing their concerns, that we are making it clear that we stand by our friends in the region, as we always have, and that we will continue to do so. What we do not want to see develop here is any sense that in the region that this is somehow a victory for Iran and a setback for the Arabs. It isn't that, but it can be perceived that way. So we've got a lot of heavy diplomatic lifting to do, not least in the region itself. I hope we are doing that.
Let's talk about the negotiations themselves, your reflections on this. How significant is the cooperation of the world powers in reaching this agreement, specifically including working with Russia under President Vladimir Putin? What's in the deal for Russia? Can you explain that?
This is one of the extraordinary aspects of this agreement that I alluded to earlier, that the five permanent members of the Security Council and Germany stood together through effectively a two-year, highly contentious negotiating process, and did not allow differences among them or allow the Iranians to play on those differences in a way that split up that international unity. So, among other things, this agreement represents what can be done in the international system when key players can put aside other differences to concentrate on a common good and a shared objective. And that we were able to keep this process together through the Ukraine crisis, for example, does show that in Moscow and in Washington, as well as the other capitals, there is a capacity to say we have incredibly grave differences between and among us. We also have extraordinarily important shared objectives. Let's concentrate on those.
Mm-hmm. Do they play, as someone who's been involved in this sort of things and talks and negotiations, does that get completely compartmentalized? Because, as you mentioned, you know, we are at loggerheads with Russia. Talk of a new Cold War between the West and Russia. Are they treated in this way completely separate? They don't enter?
Often in international diplomacy, you do have to compartmentalize. I would give you one example from our own recent history. Ronald Reagan, one of the, not the toughest U.S. president against the Soviet Union, labeling it the evil empire, nonetheless successfully negotiated important arms reduction agreements with that same evil empire. We spoke of Israel. The late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in the 90s, when asked about Palestinian terrorism in the context of then ongoing peace negotiations, said that he would negotiate for peace as if there were no terrorism, and he would fight terrorism as if there were no peace negotiations. You have to be able to make those distinctions. And I think that the international community very successfully did in the case of the Iran agreement.
Potentially a landmark, a milestone. We have mentioned a couple times the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979, but also another landmark was the 9/11 attacks. 9/11 attacks in 2001. I understand that you had contact and consultation with the Iranians in the days after 9/11.
I did. I was then Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. That covered Iran, and I was on one of the very first flights out of Dulles Airport after the flight ban was lifted in the wake of the attacks, heading for Geneva to sit down with, among others, the Iranians to talk about what we were going to do in and about Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. And so we knew at the, even that early on that Iran was not implicated in any way?
For those of us who knew the region, you know, I connected the dots. I was actually on a flight to LaGuardia the morning of the attacks. Again, one of the last planes to land in New York that day. But within hours, I had connected dots that took us to Al-Qaeda, which, of course, not only is and was our existential enemy, also an existential enemy of Iran. Mm-hmm. So you don't wait for all the forensic evidence to come in when you're negotiating in a crisis. It was pretty clear to us that we needed to engage the Iranians.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to that 1971 hostage crisis. Our acrimonious relationship dates back to that point, at least the Iran hostage crisis. How do you personally remember that event? Where were you when the hostages were taken?
I was right next door. I was in Baghdad and actually avoided being a hostage by about 10 days. I spoke Farsi. My first tour had been in Iran, and I had been ordered to go into Iran to reopen our consulate in the city of Isfahan with a report date of November 15, 1979. So I missed it by about 11 days.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker is my conversation partner at this point. He is visiting Iowa this week, and we're talking with him about the latest developments in the Middle East. Of course, the newly brokered agreement with Iran, between Iran and six powers. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker in just a moment. More of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. With more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, talking with U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He has served as U.S. Ambassador six times, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Kuwait, Lebanon, and Syria over a period of nearly four decades. He served as ambassador to almost all the Middle East countries where conflict was present. And this week, he is visiting Iowa to speak as a guest of Drake University in Des Moines. Ambassador Crocker, we talked a lot about the agreement, the newly born agreement between six powers and Iran in the first half. Certainly a lot of other things going on. What is largest on your radar, or perhaps given little attention or needs more attention in this area?
Well, it's a great question, Ben. I'd kind of start with something we talked about a few minutes ago, Iran. And I made the point that this is a nuclear agreement. It's not a broad political agreement. Don't expect the Iranians to change behavior anytime soon. And specifically, don't expect them to change in Iraq. To me, that's one of the most serious challenges we're now facing. I was ambassador there from 2007 to 2009. It just devastates me to see how Iraq has descended into chaos since that time. What are the Iranians doing? They are backing extremist Shia militias that have American blood on their hands. And they are using them as a spearhead against, effectively, Iraqi Sunnis, ostensibly against the Islamic State, but actually what they're seeking to do is, in my view, divide Iraq irrevocably into unstable rump states. It's, you know, a severe challenge from Tehran. It's one that I think only we can meet, and I'm more than a little concerned that we don't seem to be stepping up to it.
Mm-hmm. There have been conversations that you're referring to, I'm sure, the so-called three-state strategy, the partitioning, the permanent partitioning of Iraq, the Kurds in the north, the Sunnis in the center, and the Shiites in the south. So once that partitioning, if your thinking is right with the Iranians, once that partitioning takes place, then Iran would sort of take over the Shiite south? Or it would be a puppet state, or
it's. I would suggest it is Iran's plan A. It should be our plan X, a place we will never go. First, you need to understand the character of partition in conflict situations. You don't draw a clean line and. Everybody stays peacefully on their side of it. Take a look at the India-Pakistan partition in 1947. Somewhere between 2 and 3 million people died in that, that bloody process, and we are now left with its legacy, which is a badly divided South Asia between the adversaries, India and Pakistan, both with nuclear arms. Partition often does not take you anywhere happy. The other thing to look at is what would be the geostrategic result? Well, you'd get a jihadistan, if you will, in predominantly Sunni areas that would fall under, to the extent they're not already, the control of the Islamic State, really giving them that state, which would be a base for, well, we would see what it would be a base for, perhaps, among other things, the next 9/11, perhaps a stage to try to subvert Saudi Arabia and Jordan. It would be highly dangerous to the U.S. What would you get elsewhere in the country? A Kurdistan that could lead to violent friction with Turkey, which has a substantial Kurdish minority and a history of a great deal of trouble in its relations with that minority, and a Shiistan in the dominant Shia population areas that would fall even more under Iranian influence than it already is, and where most of Iraq's very, very considerable oil reserves are. So a net strategic gain for Iran, a very dangerous strategic loss for us. Mm-hmm. Why would the Iranians do this? Something Americans have long since forgotten, the Iran-Iraq War of 1980 to 1988. Iran suffered hugely in that conflict. Their strategic goal, or at least the goal for some Iranians, is to ensure that no Iraqi state can ever again threaten their security. How do you achieve that? By ensuring there is no longer an Iraqi state, perhaps in their interest, diametrically opposed to our own.
You've lamented what has happened in Iraq since the withdrawal of U.S. troops in 2011. What could have been done differently? We had no more stomach for that war, or did we? What would have been a different path?
It's a great question, Ben. In my 3+ decades in the Middle East, I learned maybe two things. One of them is be careful what you get into, that if you're playing on Middle East fields, they know the ground rules, we don't. You enter at your peril. The second thing I learned is be at least as careful what you propose to get out of. That disengagement can have consequences as great or greater than your initial engagement. And I would suggest that in Iraq, we failed on both scores.
Mm-hmm.
We were not careful what we got into, but once you're there, you're there. You can't rewind that film. You know, if you didn't like the first three acts of the play or the movie, well, the next 24 reels are going to go on without you, and you may like them even less.
Right, so, but we are a democratic country, and as I mentioned, the tide of opinion was massively against staying in Iraq.
Well, we are a democratic country, and we are a very impatient country. And in the Middle East, our allies have come to fear our impatience, and our adversaries have come to count on it. So it's a challenge for our elected leadership. You know, sometimes you don't just respond to public opinion, you try to shape it. That's what leaders do. And I think there was a case to be made why sustained U.S. engagement was very important. And the kind of engagement I'm talking about is, you know, not sending in the divisions again. It's that sustained high-level political engagement that counters what, say, the Iranians are doing. How many visits to Iran, to Iraq, has Secretary Kerry made? One. How many did Secretary Clinton make? One. That's not sustained high-level engagement, and I think we're paying the price for it.
So are you ultimately laying the blame also at the feet of President Obama's foreign policy?
Well, that's what I tried to say. We were not careful getting in 2003, and we were not careful getting out in 2011.
Mm-hmm. Okay. U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker is with us this hour. We have the pleasure of having a conversation with him this hour. He's visiting Iowa. And Ambassador Crocker, since you're in Iowa to speak, hosted by Drake University, I'd like you to get to react to a question on a recent Quinnipiac poll of likely caucus participants. This about foreign policy. Of course, you've heard about our caucuses here in Iowa. It has to do with intervention. On the front concerning the Islamic State or ISIL, 72% compared to 23% of Republicans. 72% of Republicans, likely caucus goers in Iowa, back sending ground troops to Iraq and Syria to fight this terror group. Democrats, on the other hand, oppose sending troops, 63% to 29%. What are your thoughts when you hear those numbers?
Well, first, I think that we're all looking at the wrong issue here. ISIS and its territorial gains are a symptom of a problem. They're not the cause of a problem. Islamic State, in Iraq in particular, and that, incidentally, is where it came from. It didn't just emerge overnight a year ago. Its roots are in Iraq post the 2003 invasion. They have found political space to move because of the extraordinary political divisions inside Iraq between the Sunni community in particular and the Shia-led government. ISIS exploits that. They didn't cause it. So if you're going to deal with ISIS, it isn't sending in the troops. It's sending in the American political leadership, as we were just talking about. A presidential phone call, Secretary of State visits, Secretary of Defense visits, helping the Iraqis bridge their internal divisions, something they can't do on their own. But it's only through bridging those divisions that you're really going to take ground back from ISIS. The last thing we want to do, in my view, is send in troops to try and do that on the ground. It'll make it worse. We will lose lives. And we will not solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. So when you hear some of the comments made by the candidates running for president, do you think the level of discourse, the ideas thrown out, are up to the task of dealing with this very nuanced situation?
That's a key issue here. We are a great, great democracy. ultimately, Americans are responsible for the government they get because it is an elected government. So I would suggest, and I would suggest this particularly in Iowa right now, Americans are responsible for the questions they put to their candidates. All elections turn on domestic issues, of course, but there are some pretty big national security issues out there, and I think the electorate has to demand sensible answers, not just bumper stickers. But to get a sensible answer, you've got to care enough about the issues to ask the right questions.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk in a few minutes about Afghanistan. You've mentioned it, but we haven't gone into great depth there. This week, Afghanistan has experienced several bomb attacks. Most recently, a car bomb exploded at a checkpoint near a military base housing both Afghan and international troops. The Taliban aggressively trying to seize territory in many parts of Afghanistan. They've made some gains in pockets of several provinces. Also, peace talks between Afghan officials and the Taliban expected to start after the holy month of Ramadan ends. Why is the Afghan government negotiating with Taliban? Because they have no choice.
Well, I would phrase it slightly differently. It goes back to what we were discussing concerning Iraq. Ultimately, in certainly modern times, wars end through political agreements. So seeking a political agreement to wind the Afghan war down, to me, makes a lot of sense. So I'm glad to see Afghan government representatives sitting down with the Taliban. I'm even happier that they're doing it in Pakistan, if this indicates the Pakistanis are changing their strategic logic of supporting the Taliban, as they have for the years since 9/11. I have one concern about these talks, and that is there are no women on the Afghan government delegation. And I say this not as, you know, championing human rights. This is a national security issue. And if women's voices are not heard in these peace negotiations, I do not think they're going to get to a good place.
Mm-hmm. What does a woman's voice add?
First, it makes it clear to all concerned on both sides of the table that women are indeed half the population, and they have got to be brought into a process, and they have to agree to a process. If they are pushed aside, I am afraid you are going to get a Taliban-like outcome.
Mm-hmm. What is or should be the U.S. role in these talks?
To play the role that the Afghan government wants us to play, not to play an independent role. We got into trouble with that over the last few years. By creating the appearance, at least, that we had our own agenda with the Taliban and would deal with them directly, irrespective of the damage that may do to the legitimacy of the Afghan government. So we want to be very careful at this juncture to be clear that we are there in support of the Afghan government, not in place of it.
Mm-hmm. What's the best that the U.S. can hope for in the case of Afghanistan at this point?
First, and this goes back to our conversation about Iraq, if you look at Afghanistan today, and to a certain degree, you're looking at Iraq, say, in 2010, what kind of Afghanistan do we want 5 years from now? If we want one that looks like Iraq today, then go ahead, declare the war's over, withdraw all your forces, and wish them good luck. Luck won't do it, and I think that would be the best way to bring about a further surge in violence, a further diminution of Afghan authority, a collapse of security, and a general return to the Afghanistan of the early 1990s before the rise of the Taliban.
The Taliban has declared it won't allow ISIL into Afghanistan, so you're not talking about exactly the same type of vacuum and disintegration that would allow the Islamic State in.
Well, the Islamic State is already in Afghanistan, by all accounts, in conflict with both the government of Afghanistan, in some cases with the Taliban, but they're already there, and that's what I mean about the a return to the chaos and internecine conflict of the 90s, and we know how that eventually wound up for us.
I wonder if we could spend a few words on President Obama now that he's most of the way through his second term. Talking about his foreign policy and the legacy he would have in terms of foreign policy, what do you see as his greatest achievements?
Clearly, although a lot is to be thrashed out, debated, analyzed, and so forth, the Iran agreement may stand as his most significant achievement. Even as critics would agree, they would say yes for worse rather than better. But I think as matters stand now, that would be the centerpiece of his foreign policy legacy. In other areas, again, I'm a Middle East focused guy. Not much to show. He's basically been about pulling back in Iraq, in Afghanistan, not stepping forward. Certainly the Israeli-Palestinian peace process has gone nowhere. Our traditional ties with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states have deteriorated. So certainly in the Middle East division, the Iranian agreement would be the significant accomplishment.
Is the at the top of his, in your view, failures list, would it be the way in which the U.S. exited Iraq in 2011?
As understandable as it may be, and as desired as it may have been by the majority of Americans, I am deeply concerned about the consequences near-term and long-term of a perceived general U.S. disengagement from the region. There has never been a time since the end of World War II when we have been less engaged politically in the Middle East than now. And I think not by coincidence, there never has been a time of greater tumult and chaos in the Middle East than there is now. Either we lead in that region, or other forces will take hold, and we will not find that to our benefit.
I mentioned the poll of likely caucus goers earlier. There are certainly many thousands of Iowans, likely caucus goers of both parties, listening to your conversation. What suggestions do you have for them?
I come from a particular perspective as a sort of a career-long Foreign Service officer. I would hope that the voters in Iowa will make American national security very much a theme in the campaigns and in the caucuses, and not just the bumper sticker kind of national security. For Iowans to really force candidates to think and speak about what America's national security interests and strategic interests are in the world. How do the candidates see America's place in the world? What opportunities and what dangers do they see? And if elected, what would they do to ensure that American security is safeguarded in an increasingly chaotic world? I think ensuring that there is a thoughtful discussion by candidates on those international, indeed existential issues would be a huge service that Iowa could do for the nation in this election cycle.
Okay. U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker, I want to thank you very much for this hour of conversation. We appreciate your time. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.